I'm Mel.
I'm Tiff.
And we're on Pump. And today we're sitting down with Blaine Johnson and getting an inside look at AMSEC's Government Relations Committee and the implications of allied health professions, state licensure, and public health policies.
Blaine, welcome. Thanks for going on Pump with us. How about you tell us a little bit about your journey in perfusion?
I really appreciate the opportunity to talk to you today, especially about these really interesting and I think pertinent topics. To answer your question, my journey into perfusion was not really straightforward, but rather I think one built out of like resilience and grit and determination. Interesting enough, I started my career in pharmacy actually, but just prior to finishing and like when I was about to start my rotations, my stepfather passed away from cancer. So I made the decision to step back and be there for my family back in St. Louis. And during that time, what's interesting about other professional education programs is you don't necessarily have to have a degree to start, unlike perfusion. So for me, I didn't have a bachelor's going into school. So I really took that time to finish my bachelor's and I think kind of reassess with what I wanted in life. I think I still had a passion for helping people, but wanted to do it in a little bit different way. And lucky enough, I was able to meet a perfusionist actually while I was working in an OR pharmacy, and they came up and explained what they were doing. And I was like, I'm looking for some guidance in my life. Can I come watch a case with you? And thankfully enough, they took me under their wing, and like 15 cases later, I'm like continuing to pursue applying to perfusion school. I was accepted at Texas and everything took off from there.
That's incredible. I love how you also had your MBA prior to going into perfusion. And I know you actually work with a previous classmate of mine, Ben Lamar at UChicago. And he's always talking about how well put together you are, how every, like the, of the few projects that you're a lead on at UChicago, that like emails are always sent, updates are always done, like everything is always super organized. So I was wondering if you could talk a little bit about whether or not the MBA helped you, not necessarily as a like a ladder climb in your career, but just in general, like if somebody were to get a little bored, wanted to go back to a few courses and they chose to do an MBA, like how could that help them accentuate themselves in their department?
Yeah, it's a really interesting topic because like I said, when I wanted to come out of school, I was like finishing up my bachelor's and I was looking for something to do while I applied for perfusion school. For me, having a background of 5 to 7 years in pharmacy, the easy way I think would have been to do like a master's of healthcare administration, but I wanted to think differently, right? Like think outside the box. For me to get my MBA, it was more of like the business ideals, like you were saying, the other organization structures, stuff like that. The things that maybe we don't necessarily get sometimes as clinicians. And I thought that that would be the best way to couple my clinical experience with a similar master's. And I was lucky enough to be able to do it in a year instead of 2 years. And then follow up, like I said, and go to Texas and do an accelerated perfusion education program. Everything's really fast paced. I think in 3 years, I finished a bachelor's, an MBA, and a perfusion certificate. But I think sometimes I like to see opportunities as a springboard to your success and not necessarily as failures, like moving on from pharmacy and stuff like that. I really encourage, I think, other clinicians to always continue learning, right? Like tell everyone, when you finish your degree or you finish your training, you're not always done, right? We continue with continuing education programs and stuff. If you have that drive and that passion to do more, it takes the opportunity. There's many great colleagues out there like Dave Fitzgerald and other ones who have doctorate programs. But maybe a big ask for that wasn't what you're into. So I think a master's program is something that's great as a, like I said, that stepping stone to give you more. The curriculum's usually focused specifically on those healthcare administration tasks and cover topics like healthcare management, finance, and policy. But on the other hand, an MBA really provides a more comprehensive understanding of, like you said, those business principles. And with that, the option to even specialize in healthcare administration. My program actually added that right after I graduated, so it wasn't something I could go and achieve. But I think if you're well prepared, that would be the best avenue. And as a little forward-thinking moment, I know there are a lot of perfusion schools that are out there that are looking to take their master's programs or their certificate programs to the next level. And I think you will see a lot of partnerships with especially university granting institutions where they may have concomitant or sequential MBAs and perfusion masters or so on and so forth. So I think it's really an interesting opportunity for those future students as well.
I think that's really admirable. And a lot of people go into perfusion school, then you graduate and then they're like, oh, maybe I should do my MBA. But I like how you just pre-planned this whole thing and you had a vision. All my congrats to that. So on top of the work you do clinically, as well as administratively in your role at UChicago, you also volunteer on AMSEC's Government Relations Committee. Can you talk a bit about that committee and its mission and vision?
Yeah, this is a great question. So I think really to understand the past, we have to understand the present as well. So AMSEC GRC, or Government Relations Committee, was really established in 1991, which was also a great year because I was born then. But prior to that, the hard work and dedication of AMSEC, who later becomes the American Board providing credentialing, really developed measurable standards to evaluate competency. And that, in turn, allows us to become a designated discipline by the American Medical Association in 1976. Now, following that, you see the first largest challenge to perfusion practice and licensure overall. And that comes with the 1989 California Respiratory Bill. So what's interesting about this bill is it defined the responsibilities and duties of respiratory therapists. And in turn, by doing that, by establishing that scope of practice per se, it would have prevented California perfusionists from conducting things that we're involved in, whether it be cardiopulmonary bypass or ECMO. If that bill would have gone through, perfusionists would not be legally credentialed, obviously, and then they would not be recognized. So therefore, the law would have prohibited them from being able to do those tasks. And so in 1992, later on, AMSEC gets involved, and they move from this philosophy where really the states should handle it on their own, and maybe volunteers get involved or lawyers and stuff. And we really see a strengthening of the mission to move on. In 1992, you get California with the first titling of perfusionists. And then 2 years later, you get Texas to be the first licensure state, which is actually 30 years ago. And they are the first ones to set that groundwork. Now, later on at the 1995 conference, so a year after the first licensure state, AMSEC really recommends that the state legal credentialing of perfusionists. This is the first time ever that they take this stance. And I think this really represented a significant change in the society's previous position, that AMSEC has expressed support for individual states, but they could choose to do what they wanted on their own. And then the board proactively takes this position in recommending that perfusionists pursue state legal credentialing and licensure. That's the first big movement. And then we get our mission, like you said, which is really to inform, support, and prepare the membership to effectively engage in medical practice policy issues that affects the profession, but also to deliver that high quality patient care at the end of the day. And really it gives us that support, but also legal protection as well.
That's so crazy. I didn't realize that they were the first state to pursue licensure. If you could just quickly go through the difference between some of these terms that you're throwing out there, because for me, I don't really know the ins and the outs. So titling versus licensure versus credentialing.
So when we think about titling and other legal credentialing terms, the strongest, most legally binding term is licensure, which we see 18 out of 19 states have. And then the lowest form is regulation. Now, between regulation and licensure, you get titling, which is the second least strongest. Then you get certification, and then you get licensure. So what's interesting about registration is this is you've met a minimum education requirement. So we think about registered pharmacists, registered nurses. What's interesting about that is there's no scope of practice included. There's no restrictions in who can perform a scope of practice. And there's no ongoing state oversight aside from just saying, hey, you've met these educational requirements. The next step we step into is titling. And that's where we bring in California. So for For titling, you must meet a minimum level of academic or examination criteria. It requires continuing education, and the scope of practice is usually included. And the interesting thing about titling is that no person may use that protected title unless the criteria are met. So for instance, no one that really is a licensed perfusionist or titled perfusionist in California can walk you into an OR and say, "Hi, I'm your perfusionist today." People who do not use the title are not restricted from performing the scope of practice, though. The next step we get is certification. And so that's when state agency grants like a professional status by meeting certain criteria. They may require an application and a certification fee. And here we get more governance, right? This is usually via a practice board or an advisory committee. Certified people can use the professional title, again, perfusionist, but it allows for an increased enforcement and professional practice protection when we compare it to titling. Now, our final step, which is licensure, is the highest, like we said. For this, you have mandated academic and examination requirements by law. Continuing education is also usually required. And in this step, a person cannot perform a scope of practice unless they are licensed and they possess that license. This is only except when other credentialed professionals also have overlapping scope of practice and are specifically exempt. So an example would be like nurses maybe are licensed to perform medication dispensing. So are perfusionists or point of care. So in that case, if two licensure scope of practices both overlap, then they can both do something. However, in that example that we saw in California, establishment of the respiratory therapist scope of practice to include extracorporeal oxygenation would have excluded perfusionists altogether in that state, which is really interesting because, let's see, what year was that? 1992. In 2021, almost 32 years later, we get a bill in Washington that we actually monitored and intervened in. And that was specifically, they were adding extracorporeal membrane oxygenation and extracorporeal life support to the respiratory therapist scope of practice. And that would have negated any perfusionist from performing those techniques and technologies, which is crazy because unfortunately, Washington is not a licensed state.
How we talked about overlapping scope of practice, such as medication dispensing. Oh my God, I can't speak English today. Dispensing. How is that different from the respiratory therapists, including extracorporeal membrane oxygenation, and that suddenly precluding perfusionists from having that in their scope versus that being an overlapping item?
Yeah, it's really interesting because license acts cannot be delegated to non-licensed personnel. For instance, even if respiratory therapists had established ECMO in their scope of practice, they would not have been able to say, "Hey, Mel, can you go ahead and establish this patient on extracorporeal life support?" Which is interesting because, again, if it is in a licensed scope of practice, only someone with an overlapping scope, so again, let's just say nurses also had ECMO in their scope of practice. Now they could establish ECMO, for instance, in Washington if that bill would have passed. However, perfusionists still could not, which is interesting because it's a little different than technical acts, right? Which means like a routine medical or surgical act, which does not require medical judgment and is like sometimes performed with supervision and specific to whatever the licensure may be. We see that sometimes with physicians, and especially in some states, their licensure for perfusionists is actually written within their physician licensure acts, as opposed to having their own separate kind of category.
So had that bill gone through and then perfusion decided, okay, we're going to pursue licensure in that state, then if they succeeded through the licensure application, thereafter, they'd be able to run ECMO. But until that happened, there would be a turnover of that service line from one professional to another within the hospital or within all hospitals in that area, which could also lead to, I'm not saying that respiratory therapists aren't good at ECMO. There are many respiratory therapists that are very good at ECMO, but I'm just saying, like, an abrupt service line change such as that overnight just because of a legal bill could result in some quality of care issues across the span in that state.
Yeah, and I think if that would have been enacted, you would have seen probably perfusionists continuing their day-to-day practices because we always keep our patients in mind, right? Sometimes there are all those like Good Samaritan acts and stuff that sometimes support medical professionals, but that's not always the case. What's interesting is if there is a scope of practice infringement and say a perfusionist was doing something that was with outside their scope, generally speaking, we see criminal or like fines implemented, not necessarily. What's interesting is there's not always a regulatory body that goes out and checks, right? There's not like the state of Washington's nursing board is like banging down OR doors, right? And they're like, inspection, who's doing ECMO? You right there, stop it. So while we, I think, sometimes think of the negative applications of that, I think, like you were saying, realistically, we're always going to provide what's best for the care of our patients. However, I always advocate to be more proactive rather than reactive, right? But I think this kind of set alarm bells out off for perfusionists in Washington. And we've worked very closely with their state perfusion society to work towards those steps of what's next. And that now the kind of the ball is in their hand. As the GRC, we're always monitoring for things that whether they be licensure states or not, right? We want to protect the profession as a whole. So we are able to intervene and educate people, but there might not always be the chance that we can intervene before something unfortunately happens. Yeah.
How do you audit a program for practicing out of their scope? What does that look like?
Yeah. So what's interesting is with our profession, we're so small, I don't really think you see it, right?
Yeah.
You usually see it with really robust medical professionals. Like I said, like nursing, pharmacy, boards of physicians, right? Mm-hmm. These individuals usually not only have scope of practice and license requirements, but they also have strong departments in auditing, maybe inspector generals and stuff like that. And they do send out individuals to institutions looking for those license infringements, policies and procedures not being followed, so on and so forth. What's interesting too is although we talked about the levels of legal credentialing, there's also levels of how policies take place in medicine, right? At the lowest level, you have institutional policies, right? These may say, hey, our perfusionists can do X, Y, Z, right? Mm-hmm. The next step we see is state intervention and credentialing, and then our local. And then on top of that, we see like federal regulations and stuff like that. What's interesting right now is there's no federal oversight really of perfusion. It's all done in that middle ground of the state level, or what we see in a lot of non-licensure states is policies and procedures are established, like I said, by institutions, right? So if we go back to credentialing for the ABCP, there's no states that necessarily have to require that. However, we've established as professional organizations and as a profession that is our like gold standard, right? And that is generally accepted and adopted by all institutions that have licensed perfusionists.
Mm-hmm. And I have to say from my experience, I don't feel, and I don't know if this is good or bad to say, but I don't feel like there's a lot of oversight of perfusion in many programs. A lot of people just are not familiar with what perfusionists do to some degree. If you have, say, a nurse leadership type program, a lot of times they rely on you and your expertise to make sure that you're doing all the right things. And occasionally you check in with them and say, these are my policies and procedures. I just feel like a lot of programs that I've seen are really just self-reliant. I think AMSECT really does a good job at forging for a profession and being there as a resource. But it's very interesting to hear your perspective.
Yeah, I think you have a lot of interesting key players in the game, right? For education, we have KHAP and ACPE that really drives those accreditation standards and education standards. We obviously have the American Board driving certification. But yeah, there's not really an organization that is driving licensure and legal requirements. And I think that's where AMSECT and the GRC stepped in a long time ago. But the interesting part is the last time a state was licensed, I think, was 2011, and that was Maryland. So we go from the late 90s to 2011, and we get 19 states, and then we sadly hit a wall. And I think what's interesting as we see these new technologies and techniques coming out in our profession, it's really starting to, like you said, wake up the profession to remind them of the importance of these things. Because like in a non-licensure state, there's nothing protecting someone. For instance, I get a lot like a rep coming in, right? And they may say, hey, I can do PRP, or hey, I can do organ preservation or whatnot. Sometimes those preservationists is usually what we refer to them as. But there are people out there that are holding their titles as perfusionists, right? Oh, I'm an organ perfusionist. Right. You're like, and I think that's scary because, like you were saying, in institutions that don't have that strong perfusion understanding and framework to establish what that is, sometimes you may be misled, and then they may rely on those individuals to do something that's not out, that they shouldn't be doing. I think that's the scariest and most worrisome thing that we see in the future.
Yeah, it's interesting to think about VADs as well. You have, I know for where I work currently, we have an Impella rep that comes in, and they're primarily in charge of the Impella, or like a Berlin Heart. You have reps repping for those products. So yeah, no, it's interesting to think about. I'm curious, with the advent of contract group perfusion, do you feel that there's any kind of correlation between the last time that we had a state licensure versus contract perfusion blowing up?
Yeah, that's interesting. I never really thought about the correlation. And I misspoke. It's 2013 was New York. We have to remember about New York from now.
Texas, number one.
That's right. But yeah, I think we see a lot of challenges, right? If you geographically, interestingly, look at where licensure states are, they're usually like around the ring of the bottom of the United States. And then we like have a lot like centralized in the Midwest. But yeah, other states that don't have a lot of perfusionists involved. And I don't want to say it may be kickback due to challenges of contracting groups or 1099 workers. I think sometimes where we lose our path is just getting individuals together on the same page, right? And that's really why we speak to, when we're establishing states who don't have licensure and want to get involved, we really establish that the first step is to create a state organization, right, that can speak for all the individuals in the state, as opposed to a single individual that's, hey, I have interest in licensure. Because if you can get a society together to speak for the people, that's going to carry a lot more weight than, again, an individual or even a company, right? And that's what's great is when you see establishments of these perfusion societies, it's all comers, right? All institutions, a breadth and depth of different ideals and experiences. And I think that's really helped. But what's sad is, unfortunately, we see a lot of dropout, right? So some states establish a state perfusion society, they get licensed or titled, and then the interest dwindles out. And I think for that, it's to say, hey, remember your mission and vision of why you got involved. But also, again, we talked about that tiered structured. It's really important to have organizations that speak to local and state needs and can talk about education points. You're in Texas. I applaud like the Texas Perfusion Society for invigorating their mission and vision and value and reinitiating a society. And I think that's what maybe we need more of today within our profession, is that call to action, right? To step it up at a local level and to carry that torch forward into more of a national and federal level as well.
Yeah, I can speak a little bit for Texas. I did just join the board for Texas Perfusion Organization, and it is really exciting to see people come together. Texas does hold a lot of perfusionists in our state, and we're naturally competitive. So I think it's great to bring groups together and see what everyone is doing and vouch for our licensure. And I guess my question leading from that would be, how many state liaisons does the committee currently have? And what are those job responsibilities?
Yeah, it's a really good question. So we view state liaisons as our people on the ground, right? They're holding that finger to the pulse and always understanding what's going on at that local level. Right now, we have about 30 vacancies last time I counted. So we're talking about, 3/5 of the United States that does not have a local person or within the state kind of representative to lead the charge. When we work with our state liaisons, we really encourage them to establish, like I said, that state perfusion society, but they also serve in many other aspects where they can help identify volunteers to serve in leadership positions. They may even serve on a legislative committee for a society, and even at the end of the day, really represent the state's perfusionists and professions concerns to those state legislative and regulatory authorities to be representatives of allied medical profession groups really in the state. And again, it goes back to when we get these issues like Washington, right? Sometimes having an organization like AMSEC step in and tell them what's going on is important, right? We're happy to intervene and protect the profession, but nothing really fires up a lawmaker or a regulatory commissioner more than their constituents coming to them with their concerns and saying how it's going to impact them, not only as individuals, but their community as well. When you paint the picture that, you know, for instance, if respiratory therapists were to be the only people to have ECMO, and you go to the biggest city or county's legislative body and say, hey, our heart center is going to have to shut down providing ECMO until this is resolved, I think that really fires them up. And all of a sudden, they're interested in helping find a equal path for everyone, as opposed to a national organization sometimes providing representation. So that's really what we lean on our state liaisons to do. And they have many other requirements and goals that we meet together. But I really encourage anyone that's interested in being a state liaison to review the AMSEC GRC website and fill out that willingness to serve form, because we're always looking for individuals to partner with in those states.
What does the process of lobbying government look like, depending on the issue? And how do these state liaisons stay abreast of all these topics? Is it like a Google alert or?
Yeah, those are great questions. So we'll start with lobbying at its basic level. The two really big parts of lobbying are either a grassroots effort, and that usually means individuals, state perfusion societies, societies that do not provide a monetary resource into lobbying, and they go on it on. And I think of this as a more personal or individual level, right? So maybe Mel, Tiff, and I get together and we go down to our state legislator. We knock on their office and we say, hi, we're perfusionists. We have this concern. We have this goal in mind of achieving licensure. How can we partner together to create a bill and then move it forward through the process? So that's a grassroots level. The second, which we see in a lot of other professional organizations, but however requires a lot of income and incentive, is hiring your own lobbyist to do that individual legwork for you, which is really interesting because back in the beginning when the GRC actually began, the chair was actually a lobbyist. Lee Bechtel paved many roads and paths, I think, for AMSEC of where we are today in terms of government relations. But having an expert sometimes in that political arena can really allow you more opportunity. And they have that network sometimes, right? That's built in and they know who to go to and what to do. But again, sometimes that comes at a financial cost. So those are the two pathways usually we see. Again, usually what happens is state a society or a number of individuals have an idea, right? In this case, maybe seeking perfusion licensure. Then the first thing you want to do is identify a partner who's going to lead the charge and be your bill sponsor. So usually for these individuals, again, we either look towards lawmakers that have a connection to you, maybe your local lawmaker or someone who has maybe even been impacted by cardiac surgery or perfusionists. The other option is to partner with lawmakers who have an expertise in healthcare or may sit on healthcare committees within their state legislative body. And those are sometimes best because they understand the political arena, how it revolves around healthcare and licensure. And sometimes they can help paint that path forward. And then once you identify that, usually that lawmaker will work with their team to create a bill. AMSECT actually has a, what we call like a template, right? Our building block for state licensure. We hand it to you and say, hey, here's this template. Do with it as you please, right? And then the state lawmakers team goes through and they say, this doesn't really jive with our state or this sounds best. And they put their own little unique twist on it, right? After they created the bill or the practice and what it looks like, then they move it on to either gaining support from other lobbyists or lawmakers, right? To say, hey, Mel, I have this Perfusion Practice Act. Will you support me in this? Or they go to the overall body and ask for a vote or a reading. And usually from there, generally speaking, laws don't pass right away. I don't think there's ever been a law where it goes up for a reading, everyone votes yes, and it moves on to the next body. Generally speaking, laws are read. And once they've determined what the best path forward is, it goes to a committee. And again, because those are the experts, right? Whether it be finance, ways and means, whatever your state may have. Generally speaking, there's some side of oversight for healthcare. Usually once the committee's reviewed it, they think it's great, they've made their tweaks, then they send it back to the main body for voting. And if it passes or ratifies, it usually moves into the other side. So if you're in the Senate, it moves to the House or vice versa. Once it's approved there, then usually it goes to the governor for signage or enact or veto sometimes. And then they make the appropriate changes from there. And then your state's licensed. But the challenges we see sometimes are timing. What's interesting is legislative calendars don't run January to December. They sometimes have very short terms. So sometimes you may need to start your lobbying very early on so that you can get that bill in as soon as possible. If not, sometimes they call what we call like sign die. So basically they say, oh, our calendar has ended this year. All bills that are on the calendar are no longer considered and they have to be reintroduced in the following legislative calendar. Sometimes you see a lot of continue over or reinitiation of bills for that. So the timing is really important of when you're lobbying and when you're introducing. And then what's your follow-up question? I already forgot.
It's okay. I already forgot too. That was great info though.
About lobbying and something else.
Yeah. Even from off of that, actually, I had a different question too. Is I remember this past year at AMSECT, somebody had brought up running isoflurane on bypass. And another comment came from the other mic at the same time as that question did about how licensure can assist with including that in the scope of practice, depending on the state. Can you talk a little bit about that as an overall issue and the nuances of perfusion running this anesthetic gas on bypass?
Yeah, I think it's really interesting because this kind of goes back to the scope of practice, right? And how licensure regulations are created. And remember, again, there's a difference between certification and licensure, right? Certification is non-legal. Certification is voluntary. So again, becoming a CCP, whereas licensure is a legal term, right? Licensure may be mandatory and it defines that scope of practice. Some examples that we see, like you said, are anesthetic gas, administration of medications such as heparin, blood administration, point of care testing, who can set FiO2 and sweep and stuff like that. But again, it goes back to what we talked about, that sometimes if a license act is written into anyone's license, it cannot be delegated to a non-licensed personnel. So again, that's where these protections for scopes of practice are really important and why we're always updating them to include the newest technologies and techniques. Sometimes I think you see overarching policies, again, at an individual institution level, and that usually can sometimes supersede a little some conflicting data of policies that we see like at a higher level. For instance, if your institution says that a perfusionist may administer isoflurane, then that kind of covers you at the institutional level. And sometimes that's like the best way to start. And then we move up the building blocks like we talked about earlier from there.
Blaine, we touched on this, but we talked about that not all states have perfusion state licenses. The ones that do, the process for the application and approval can be different, and the prerequisites for approval can also be very different. So what are some of the most niche components you've seen across various state licensures?
Yeah, it's really interesting because like we talked about earlier, sometimes the states take our template and they move their own twist to it. Sometimes we see, you know, things as simple as fingerprinting or criminal background checks. Sometimes we see states such as Texas, where you're at, or I can't think of the other state right now, but they Wisconsin, and they require a jurisprudence exam before you can even sit for licensure. We see other states also that have what we call like a temporary licensure for new grads or people who move into the state. And sometimes those requirements can be a little different than the full requirements for overall licensure as well. Some other things that we're working on to resolve currently in one state is Nevada. And that's because their current Legal Practice Act reads that if a new grad does not pass their exam on the first time, they can never sit and be a perfusionist ever in the state of Nevada, which is crazy, right? Because as a profession, that's not really the stance we take, right? Yeah. And again, I think it comes from someone who didn't understand the profession or understand how the examination process works and stuff like that. So that's one state that we're actively intervening, and we finally got really great representation on the perfusion advisory committee. That's something they're working to adjust right now. And that's interesting because again, like we talked about the reinitiation of state organizations, but it's also important to always revisit your licensure and make updates, right? There are some states who have been around since the 90s who have never once updated their licensure acts or changed the scope of practice. And I think that's really interesting because we see the major changes, right? You and Mel are on the ICBEP committee, and I think you guys are actively working as a committee to create an updated scope of practice. And I welcome you guys to talk about it a little because I think the changes that I've seen sitting on it, there's major changes that we're bringing to the scope of practice to bring in all those new technologies and techniques. And if without it, then we're not really staying up to date and we're not really protecting our profession and our practice as a whole sometimes.
So from a legislative perspective, including staffing shortages, what do you feel is going to be the role of the TN visa and employment?
Yeah, it really involves a lot of hot topics, I think, right? So I'll start with the board. This year, effectively, as all perfusionists have probably been notified, they have made effective August 1st, I think, of this year to where a rotation for your 75 cases must be completed in the United States. And I think that the board is trying to be forward looking and has a very positive stance on why they've made this change. But I think to your question, it's in turn precluded others from allowing their advancements and opportunities. Hindsight's kind of 20/20 sometimes, right? So we see the impacts on protecting our licensure and certification, which I think is very important. But at the same time, we have to remember our goals of why we do these, right? And I keep saying, it's about the patients and who we help. So whether that means that perfusionists come from the United States, right, and are educated, or we create future pathways of success to allow others to come in, whether it be Canada, Mexico, internationally. I think that's a hot topic that we have to address. Like I alluded to, KHAP is making major changes for perfusion education and education of allied health professionals as a whole. And they are now requiring that institutions have a framework to allow international opportunities. So I think that because of KHAP's stance on that, for instance, opening a perfusion school in maybe the Arab Emirates at Cleveland Clinic, Saudi Arabia, they have to allow the opportunities to create that in the future. However, the board has taken a stance which has precluded that from happening, right? Because although KHAP may allow them to be successful and receive their education there, which may be a future opportunity, then they would have to come back to the United States to receive those cases. And again, I think the intentions are good. I think their thought process is that perfusion practice in the United States may be different internationally, in that if you're going to say that you are a certified clinical perfusionist within the United States, that this is the education and knowledge requirements, I can definitely buy that. But I think we have to sometimes, again, think outside the box and think of other avenues that we can allow individuals to be successful in as well. But you've alluded to other individuals during this podcast that are a part of the community, that are driving guidelines in Europe, that are coming to America for additional opportunities. And unfortunately, because of regulations or other requirements, they're not allowed to practice perfusion. And at the end of the day, I think that's sad because these people are who we look to for our organizations, for presentations, like I said, for guidelines. And the fact that they can't practice sometimes breaks my heart because I look toward them for mentorship and education. And we really should be able to create maybe in the future an avenue where we can allow opportunities between each other. So what's interesting is if you think about like European licensure or Australian licensure, which is very strong, there are no pathways to see equal accreditations between each other. Almost like a compact licensure, right? That says, hey, if you met the education and case requirements in Europe and you fill out said requirements, then we will allow you to practice and be a CCP as well. We see that from a AMSEC perspective of GRC with the TN visas. And that kind of goes back to NAFTA, which is the North American Free Trade Alliance, which was also renamed the last time they did it. But anyways, NAFTA basically allows for opportunities from Canada and Mexico for individuals to obtain work visas within certain listed medical professionals, right? Such as dentists, physicians, so on and so forth. Unfortunately, in the 90s and most recently, maybe less than 5 years ago, when they reviewed the professionals that were on that list, perfusionists were left out. So we have been working at the federal level for the first time to allow potential legislation to be introduced that will add perfusionists to those requirements, and therefore they would be able to obtain, whether it be a TN1 visa, I think, which is for Canada, or a TN visa for Mexico, or vice versa. And so if they have education and requirements that are met, then they would be able to get a visa at least to work in the United States. Now, the second part of that is once they've come into the United States on that visa, how do we allow them to practice, whether it be licensure at a state level or certification at a national level? Thankfully for Canada, we have very strong relationships with our allies up there. And if you sit at or are educated at a Canadian perfusion school, you do meet the ACP or ABCP requirements for certification. However, we do not have anything written for our colleagues in Mexico. And that's interesting because Latin America is really up and coming in the certification body. And I know that ABCP has worked closely with Latin America to create their certification, but we haven't really taken those steps forward to see them in the same light we do as Canada. So again, I think opportunities of future involvement would really be great for our profession. And we can start in North American, I think, alliance first, and maybe work our way out into other countries as well.
I think if I'm not mistaken, the H-1B visa would be another option as well, right? Like apart from the TN visa. I think it's used a lot for specialty employment, but I believe that some specialized doctors can utilize the H-1B visa to work here. But the other issue too is that with that CCP is that most state licensures, I think the KHEP accreditation is, like you were saying, with Canada and the US. So even if somebody were to get a TN visa when they arrive here, their education would not meet the requirements for the mandatory CCP to practice here, right? So we still have that extra hurdle, even though when you look at medical doctors, I think that their pathway is that if you're an MD in another country, you can come and you can sit for the boards and then you're just required to redo your residency. I could be spewing this so wrong. There's probably an MD like cringing listening to this, but I'm pretty sure they just need to redo their residency. Like they don't need to go back and do their first 2 to 3 years of didactic work that med school requires. So it's interesting that we haven't set up our schooling in a way where you finish a didactic year, do your basic science half of your cert as a prereq to get you to go do your clinical rotations. And that pathway would allow anyone internationally to come in and just straight away sit for the basic science, get checked off on that so they don't have to pay for the extra year of tuition, and then just do the clinical rotations, which counts as a credit-bearing course at that university.
Yeah, I think you bring up some really insightful topics that are definitely need to be, I think, explored more in the future, right? I totally agree that we need some type of successful pathway of individuals who do not have their education within the United States, right? And so what does that look like? Unfortunately, no one's really taken a step, like you said, have taken the chance to explore what those paths would be look like. For me, like we talked about in the beginning, like my education has always been accelerated, right? Like in my mind, you can do anything for a year, whether that be didactics or clinical rotations, right? It's very powerful, the opportunities you can do within 12 months. So what does that look like? Could it be the future, similar to physicians, how they have their step exams, like you were saying, where you have to pass step one to be able to move to your next year of schooling, and then step two and so forth, and then you get board certification later on? That's actually really interesting that I think people have never thought about. The interesting part about that, though, is how do accelerated programs do that when your didactics and your rotations are all at the same time, right? For master's programs, it's a very stepwise approach, which maybe makes sense, right? Step one year, you get your didactics done, take your PBSE, and then step two, do your rotations, do your CAPE at the end, which would be an interesting pathway. However, in a program like Texas, where I went, where you're like doing a residency or a fellowship, where you're being educated in the morning and pumping a case in the evening or whatnot, I think it would be an interesting hurdle to see how we fit that into the structure. But I totally agree that something has to be done. And us as professionals, we have to be advocating for change and thinking outside of the box. And I think that's maybe what our profession needs today in 2024 is to think about these things and how we can restructure our strong building blocks to be more successful in the future to meet those demands of shortages or education lapses or whatnot.
I'm a strong advocate for that and obviously think that international relationships are very important moving forward and kind of collaborating all of our ideas just so that we can advance as a profession. But speaking of those international relationships and ongoing projects, are there other projects in the queue for the GRC that you guys have been discussing?
Yeah, it's a good question. So I think from a GRC standpoint, we just alluded to one of the big things is working on the NAFTA at a federal level. The second one that we've talked about discussing is compact licensure. I'm not sure if you've ever heard of compact licensure, but we actually all have one. You have your driver's license. That's the first and strongest compact licensure within the United States. So basically, it says that if you have a license in a certain state, that you've met certain requirements and that has been able to be provided in other states a competency as well, right? So we see that currently with the Veterans Administration and the Department of Defense. For our colleagues that work in those organizations, generally speaking, if you have a license in any state, They allow you to work at any other site throughout the United States because you've met those requirements and overarching education goals and certification requirements. What's interesting about compact licensure is that we have to maintain a certain level. So we alluded to that we only have 19 currently titled or licensure states. In order to get funding from the Department of Defense and get everyone on board that does compact licensing throughout the United States, we have to reach the number 30. So we have about 11 states to go, which is really good because I think we're headed there, right? We see a lot of states coming to us that have interest. I think last time I counted, there were maybe 6 to 7 states who are interested in starting to pursue. But I think sometimes just saying that is much different than following through with it. And I think that's what us as a profession, we need to work on, taking that to the next level to where we can reach state licensure. So really, if we think about a roadmap to advancing the profession, I think number one, it would be like nominate or volunteer to be a state liaison. Number two would be to establish or kind of rejuvenate, like Texas, that state society. Number three, you would hopefully seek state licensure, followed by number four, where you would review and strengthen regulations. And like number five would be that we pursue a interstate compact licensure. What's crazy to me is that, again, aside from your driver's license, there are so many other professions out there that already have compact licensure, like your barber or your hairstylist, nurses, other technical or professional organizations as well. And on top of that, it is really beneficial because it's going to save us not only manpower, right? So I live in the state of Illinois, right? So we touch several other states that if we had compact licensure and we were on the border, we could go help out our colleagues in other states in practice. But also from that financial standpoint of not having to pay $150, $200 per license per state. If you do the math, that's a lot of money if you were to be titled or licensed in all states currently. By having a compact licensure, generally speaking, there's one lump sum that you pay that's usually like maybe $100, $150. And then that allows you to practice in all 50 states, which would really be our goal. But again, we can't really obtain compact licensure until we have the drive and have the additional states as well. And then past that, I think, like you said, is the importance of international education and licensure as a whole and what that means. For AMSECT as an organization, you have to remember that although they are American extracorporeal technology, we have a strong arm in international collaboration, right? With our international conference and being a part of that. So I think in the future, we can help not only monitor and guide licensure and governance in our own backyard, but maybe we help our colleagues internationally as well to be successful.
That's awesome. So on the website, just so people are aware, because I want to, off the heels of you saying that we need state liaisons, is that on the AMSECT website, if they just go to Google and write AMSECT Government Relations Committee, they could get that sublink right at the top instead of clicking through the website. And on there at the bottom, there should be an email, like a contact email for people who are interested in volunteering for that committee. I think they could just email you guys directly through that, correct?
Yeah. And then I can send you the link too if you want to post it or anything like that.
That was a great way to close, Blaine. Look, nobody asked me, but the reason I'm here is because I want to learn things that I truly know not very much about. So I do feel a lot smarter after this on pump session with you. I appreciate you. And you do look pretty dressed up, suit and tie. And it looks like maybe not for us, but for that musical.
So that's so right. I'm always ready to lobby.
Perfect. You played the part well. And I'm sure you're excited to run off to your musical. So any last thoughts? Otherwise, we're really happy to have you on today.
Yeah, no, I really appreciate your guys' time and the opportunity to speak with you today. Again, I think this is great that we're seeing individuals involved in the profession and giving light to important topics. And I hope that we can continue to advocate for change in the future and see where our profession takes us.
Thank you so much.
Thanks so much, Blaine.
Yeah, bye, guys.
That's a wrap for this episode, your source for all things perfusion. If you have any questions, comments, or topics you'd like us to cover, please send us an email at pumpcasters pumpwithus@gmail.com. Don't forget to subscribe so that you never miss an episode. Until next time, keep the blood flowing and an eye on your level. From the latest techniques to the biggest challenges and trends, we cover it all on Pump, the perfusion podcast that never misses a beat.